RTE Factual.
And now in the Sunday sequence, we begin a new series of Left Brain, Right Brain, in which Mary Mulvihill explores various artistic and scientific collaborations. This week, dignified kings play chess on fine green silk.
Dignified is domain.
Yes.
Kings
is kingdom.
Play
is phylum.
Chess
is class.
Arm
is order.
Fine
is family.
Green
is genus.
Silk
is species.
So this is dignified kings play chess in fine green silk.
And that's the intriguing title of Carl Grimes' exhibition, based on his year as artist-in-residence at the Natural History Museum. I met with Carl and Museum Director Nigel Monaghan in the Gallery of Photography in Dublin's Temple Bar to discuss the project. But first, here's that title again.
Dignified is domain.
Yes.
Kings.
Is kingdom.
Play.
Is phylum.
Chess.
Is class.
Arm.
Is order.
Fine.
Is family.
Green.
Is genus.
Silk.
Is species.
So this is dignified kings play chess on fine green silk.
So dignified kings play chess on fine green silk, a mnemonic for remembering the hierarchy of how we order living things in the natural kingdoms, the Linnaean system that was developed 200, 300 years ago.
In the 18th century.
Okay, so about hierarchy and order and organisation.
Well, you know, the Victorian Museum is premised on that order, and it was made manifest in the Victorian Museum, so that very much so the Natural History Museum is evidence of that, and it became a museum which was a museum about accessibility to a general public, as opposed to the cabinets of curiosities that predated these museums in the 19th century, and that's very specific to the Victorian Museum. And not just to the Natural History Museum in Dublin, but most Victorian museums.
One of Carl's responses to this Victorian museum was to produce glamorous portraits of some of the stuffed specimens.
This is part of a series of about 100 animal portraits, specimen portraits, taxidermal portraits called the Sartorial Taxa series, based on the Sartorial Tailor. I started to try to represent the specimens as kind of post-mortem photographs in the fashion of 19th century post-mortem photographs, where children or adults would be photographed after they died by photographers with the in the photographer's studio or at home as by way of memory. And the kind of formal portraiture that entails was a key to the structuring and the presentation of these.
They're wonderful photographs. They are, would we say, larger than life in some cases. There's an owl, beautiful, beautiful colour. These are taxidermy stuffed specimens from the museum. And intriguingly for me, because these are obviously very dead, in fact, it's hard to get something more dead than that in one sense, and yet your photographs bring them wonderfully alive. You would expect that the photograph at that kind of extra remove would make it even more dead. And yet, to me, it's incredibly lively and animated.
It was really an attempt to make the object a present subject, in a way, and bring them to life, animate them, yet still retain that sense that they're on the verge of being. With very dramatic, almost fashion lighting, you know, taking from 19th century portraiture, daylight, key daylight lighting, on a set constant black background. But if you look closely, you can see the upper galleries and the skylight of the museum reflected in the eyes, particularly in the larger photographs, the 6 feet tall photographs. And this was about really a typology of taxidermal specimens in the Natural History Museum, and this would apply to many other museums around the same time and later.
And I love the way the eyes engage with you, very much like a fashion portrait of, you know, something from the catwalk, speaking to me out of the photograph. Nigel Monaghan, I mean, how do you react to these photographs of the specimens in your keep?
Well, they certainly, as you say, look more lively. I mean, it's amazing what good lighting will do. The Naturalist Museum is a very simple building with very basic lighting, which it's largely daylight, and that's been there for 150 years. So understandably, when you want to take photography at high quality level, it's all about the light. And that light, to an extent, is a headache in the Natural History Museum because it's not the photographer's controlled space of the studio. And yet, these things are really lively. They're also against simple black backgrounds, so they stand out. If you go to the museum, and most museums of this generation, they're very cluttered places. You hardly notice the vulture because there's another big bird right beside it. But here you have a portrait of the vulture as he might like to be thought of with his dignified black background.
The museum opened in 1857, so the order of 150 years ago, but the collection actually dates back to the 1790s when it was begun by the Dublin Society, or the RDS as we know it now. And as it happens, that's around the time when experiments with what we would recognise as modern photography begins. So Sir Humphrey Davy in London is experimenting with silver chemicals on leather in about 1800. So the collection kind of parallels the development of, or at least coincides with the development of photography. Are there early photographs in your collection? Was photography used in the museum in its early days at all?
Photography only came in terms of what's preserved in our archives in the late 19th century as interiors to show the wonderful buildings that had been refurbished. The museum itself, built in the 1850s, there are no contemporary photographs, even though photography was an option. Neither were there line drawings or any other type of illustration in anything that we've seen in our museum archives. And photography was very much just used as, look at the wonderful building we've recently refurbished in the late 19th century. And in fact, the photography in the Natural History Museum is coeval with the opening of the Kildare Street Museum. They got a photographer to go around with the large format glass plate negative cameras to take those portraits. So they're fascinating social documents, but they don't tell us an awful lot about the zoological specimens on display.
Whatever about the scientific merit of the early photographs in the museum collection, science does meet art in Carl Grimes's photography project. And of all the art forms, photography is arguably the most scientific and technological. Even its origins are scientific. Tanya Kang is director of the Gallery of Photography.
I think what's extraordinary about photography is it's actually quite hard to find out when it really did begin. You could argue that the first photograph was, in fact, looked at by an Arab astronomer called Al-Hazen in the 10th century, or is it the 11th century? I can't remember. And he was using the principle of the camera obscura to look at images of eclipses. And a camera obscura is really, it's the optical heart of photography. It is the principle whereby light passing through a very small hole will project an image from what's outside into a darkened room, or camera obscura, as in dark room. And so once that kind of principle is understood or starts to be used, it's, to me anyway, it's more a matter of kind of cooking and chemistry to actually work out ways of brightening the image, say, with the interposition of a lens into the hole or the aperture, and then a matter of sloshing around with some chemicals to try to find ways of fixing the image that is cast in the dark room.
So that you can actually capture and fix that and freeze frame that moment.
Exactly, yes. Now, in a way, that's perhaps also looking at things with the lovely benefit of hindsight, because perhaps those early images from the camera obscuras, we wouldn't recognise them as photographs at all. They would be blurry, they would be out of... there would be no kind of point of reference for them.
But they're also moving as well too. I mean,
they're moving.
Fixed.
They're live and they're real time and they're, you know, there's so many kind of differences. In fact, so in a way, the kind of pictorial side of photography got developed really from the time of the development of linear perspective in painting. So with that kind of development, you have a kind of an understanding of what a picture is. Be it is a view, it is static, it is framed, it has a kind of receding sense of distance within it. And it was those two developments, the understanding of the camera obscura principle and then the kind of development of a set of pictorial conventions that allowed you to accept what is cast by the camera obscura as a picture, as a valid picture, and as something that people would want to kind of make and freeze and keep. That those two things then really kind of form the optical side of photography. And then the other kind of equally scientific, but, you know, a different science, obviously, is the more alchemical side, where pioneers like, I think it was Thomas Wedgwood, for example, the crockery man, he did a lot of work on trying to work out how to fix images and working with various salts and so on. And perhaps one of the bigger names then would be Fox Talbot. And he worked out the closest to photography, although we generally then say that photography was developed by the Frenchman Louis Daguerre, who made rather different kinds of photographs, but they were probably more recognisable to us now as photographs, although they didn't have negatives and they couldn't be repeated, and those kind of aspects were lost to it. So photography is actually quite a complicated thing. It's got many guises and many kind of strings to its bow, which you could focus in on or not, as the case may be, like the reproducibility of it. For something to be a photograph, must it be reproducible? Must it have a negative, for example? Or is it more like a daguerreotype, where it can be a one-off, a captured silver image?
So, what's a photograph? Today we use digital cameras and throwaway images, but the photographs they took 100 years ago for the museum were on glass plates. Well, Carl Grimes has brought these two technologies together for his exhibition, Dignified Kings Play Chess on Fine Green Silk.
Yes, it was a way of bringing the museum into the gallery, but this time bringing the archival, the photographic archive of the museum into the gallery and juxtaposing those images. And if we look on the walls here to the right, we've a Rossmoor pig juxtaposed with a very rich interior photograph highlighting the skylight of the museum. It was, in a sense, a juxtaposition of, you know, the elite in interior, the architecture of display with the vernacular and the architecture of the vernacular.
And the interior, is one of your photographs, but the Rossmoor pig is a pig. When does the photograph date from? It's a pig out in the open, in a field.
It dates from 1900, photographed by Wise, a royal photographer from Belfast. And really it was just the sense of, you know, as I said, the Ireland outside of an elite. And outside of that architecture of display, which is specific to the interior in the Natural History Museum.
What technology is it using? I mean, in 1900, what kind of photograph was it?
It's a glass plate.
But photography is probably a novelty nowadays when everything is digital, to remember back 10 years to when it came on a flexible roll. But 100 years ago, it came on a glass plate. It was a stable, flat surface that you could paint with a chemical that would react to light. And it's amazing for me how not only did they travel around the Irish landscape on the back of a horse and preserve these glass plates, but these were also used in Antarctic exploration. There are 19th century glass plates from very difficult parts of the world, and photography now for the average person in the street is so available. And it was such a rarity and very complex and difficult to produce the most basic photograph 100 years ago.
And heavy in terms of equipment.
Yes, a portable darkroom was quite an undertaking.
Definitely, particularly with the wet process. You lifted your whole studio to location if you could.
So you had to be strong, rich, creative and a dab hand in the lab. Early photography was costly, complex and very chemical.
who were the early photographers, and how was photography used in those early days?
It was very much the gentleman or indeed gentlewoman's pursuit. So if you look at the early sketchbooks that were published, it's very much to... It's the next thing from doing your watercolours. So you will dabble in a bit of photography. You obviously, it needs money, it needs a certain amount of kind of know-how. But I don't think it was quickly taken up in a what we would understand now as a very scientific sense. In fact, it was taken up commercially anyway by the miniaturists, or those are the people that kind of economically it displaced. So people getting the cheap likeness, getting the small little carte de visite card, that's the first kind of burgeoning use of it, and an incredibly industrialised early system for it. You could go in, you could get your picture taken, you could go walk out with your cards, all in a matter of a day. And these were hand-coloured, hand-painted, coloured in after the effect, but almost as quick as for us to go into the photo mat.
But photography, within years of its invention, became used for lots of uses, including pornography, and then there's a similarity there with new media from the mm-hmm. the 1980s and 1990s. Its first use was in the realm of desire and pornography, which is something that
Or indeed
to
then in the famous pictures of the Paris Commune, the communards, for uses as kind of state control, and pictures were taken of these unfortunates.
Exactly.
As a kind of a warning, or as a, you know, get to know these people's identities and their, you know, persona non grata.
It became part of an instrument of the state of surveillance and also used by the sciences, and particularly the quasi-sciences, in terms of, you know, developing taxonomies of criminals and particularly towards the end of the 19th century, its use was very focused in terms of documents and filing system and distributions of known criminals and facial types and etc. etc.
That taxonomy kind of echoes your own work with portraits, Carl.
In a way, it's a kind of a play on typologies, and the typology was something in the 19th century that was explored, that if you could discover a facial type, a nose type, a race type that had a proclivity to commit certain types of crime, you could file these, distribute them, and then you had information so that you could detect crime in advance of it happening.
One of the early scientific applications of photography that I've come across is the studies of motion by the English photographer Edward Muybridge. Can you tell me about those, Tanya?
I think it was, as I understand it, the result of a bet that nobody actually knows how a horse gallops, or does a horse, are a horse's legs off the ground all at the same time when galloping. So in order to win his bet, Muybridge set up this very elaborate system of multiple cameras and triggers as a horse runs through these triggers. And I discovered, yes, indeed, the horse does, in fact, all four legs are off the ground at one point. And I think then this kind of studies of motion, in the same way that Carl was talking about, a sort of need to classify, to analyse down, to break everything down to its small, you know, atoms, to try to find the atom of movement. We have the same thing with Edgerton's famous image of the water drop.
Does it help to understand the science and the technology involved in photography and in increasingly technical digital cameras, for instance?
Oh yes, it's the language. You need to understand it to use it and to employ it, but also 19th century processes. It was one consideration of mine in undertaking this project was to actually go back to the technology of
1857 and employ that in terms of the document. And there was one way of proceeding which I didn't employ for practical reasons. Another option I considered was to use the kind of print effects and processes like the tintypes of that period for this. But I think that overlaid a kind of a sense of nostalgia to the project when I attempted a series of works in that vein. And instead I wanted to use a sort of a contemporary feel and look to the exhibition, but try to situate that within the consciousness of the kind of Victorian collector mind and reflect that visually in terms of order and grids and structure and drama, you know, the sense of dramatic taxidermy, which you see particularly towards the end of the 19th century, where the early taxidermal specimens were kind of lifeless and limp. Now, there's very little evidence in my research in the Natural History Museum here, as limited as it is in terms of the specimens that photography was employed to, as a first stage of the taxidermal process, which particularly in the Natural History Museum in New York, this was the basis of most of the taxidermy. The photographs were taken, series of photographs were taken, and certain ones were used to copy in terms of the sculpting, you know, of the final taxidermy specimens. Technology, contemporary imaging was used, and all of this project was digitally based. It's sort of a dry photography as opposed to wet photography.
Rockabill, Tusker, Fastnet, Minehead, Eagle Island, Inishtrahull, Tory, Slyne, Skellig, a lightship, a lighthouse.
This is the soundtrack to Carl Grimes' installation, Killed Striking. It's about research done 100 years ago at the museum into birds that were killed striking lighthouses. Now, the museum has always done research, even though it's stuffed with dead specimens and affectionately known as the Dead Zoo.
Well, in some ways, our Natural History Museum is eccentric. It was benign neglect of the 20th century that meant that you were left with a Victorian-style interior. And a lot of people think that's it and that's what it's all about. But in fact, it's a scientific research institution. So basically, behind the scenes, you have much larger collections, certainly in terms of numbers. And particular scientific research has been carried out over centuries on our material. Nowadays, it might be the latest technology exploring DNA, but 100 years ago, it could be something like trying to understand the variety of birds that occur in Ireland and where do the migratory species disappear to in winter.
And how was that investigated?
Well, the earliest substantial exercise was by a man called Barrington, and he was based in Bray, County Wicklow, and he had this marvellous idea to write to all of the lighthouse keepers of Ireland who were around the coast, had few things to do apart from maintaining the lighthouse and had time on their hands. And he got them to post him up the clipped-off wings and clipped-off legs of the dead birds that they found around their lighthouse each morning. So the birds might have been blown off course by storms, or they might have been just simply exhausted and flown into the light, thinking that this was the right direction to head. But the death toll around a lighthouse was substantial, and this was a great research resource, as Barrington saw it. That was his scientist's view, and he got people to post him these legs and wings up to Bray, and he produced a book using this information to plot the general distribution of birds flying past the Irish coastline.
Carl Grimes, you had access not just to the museum, the public museum, but also to behind the scenes. Mm. How did you respond to this Barrington collection of bits of thousands of birds?
I found it fascinating. I was attracted to Barrington's project and Barrington's life and his passion and almost verging on the neurosis with this long project for 20 years with lighthouse keepers. The collection is boxed and archived in the storage area of the museum. But as an artist, and there were so many players involved in this, lighthouse keepers, postmen, Barrington himself, the Irish lightships, the postal service, his wife, his family in Fossarone, and then this archive of birds' legs and wings and letters from lighthouse keepers and schedules and multifarious envelopes and bits and pieces, all very carefully catalogued by Barrington and shown in his museum in Fassa Road before he gave his collection to the National Museum in 1916. So my project really began in looking at ways to represent this information apart from, you know, the literal sort of narrative involved. And that really resulted in this large piece of 39 archival prints called Kill Striking One.
Kill Striking from birds killed striking the light.
The lantern beams of lighthouses.
And what have we here?
These are 39 archival prints, photographs of juxtapositions of parts of the Barrington Archive. The original envelopes and wings and labels and letters. And the
envelope has a very black, a very prominent black border. It's like a mortuary envelope.
There's a kind of a metaphor going on here with new technology. You have mail, also a funereal envelope, and the whole sort of, obviously, the death, very central to this whole project. But yes, the black line also is a very sort of graphic outline in terms of, you know, its form, its visual form.
Rockabill. Tusker, Fastnet, Minehead,
it takes your breath away. It is very, very beautiful, very strange, very intriguing, very. It draws you in, it literally makes you kind of want to walk up close to it. And I think then, kind of as a statement about a social time, it has so many interesting threads running through it. You could look at it as also wonderful testament to the various kind of modes of communication of the time, that here a sort of gentleman scientist is there galvanizing a whole team of lighthouse keepers and lightship keepers to get involved in science. And I think Carl has done a really important job in kind of commemorating it and celebrating it, actually, for its strange beauty.
If you'd like to see some of the work we were discussing, then go to carlgrimes.net, and a monograph from the exhibition, Dignified Kings Play Chess on Fine Green Silk, is available from the Gallery of Photography and the National Museum. I was talking to artist Carl Grimes, the director of the Natural History Museum, Nigel Monaghan, and the director of the Gallery of Photography, Tanya Kyang. The music was John Field's Nocturne in B-flat, played by Una Hunt, and the soundtrack for Killed Striking was created by Carl Grimes and composer Tom Lawrence.
Left Brain, Right Brain was presented by Mary Mulvihill and produced by Owen Brady. You can hear the second programme in the series next Sunday evening at 10 here on RTE Lyric FM.